I'm Scott Schiff with the Atlas Society. I'm again honored to host these two great minds, Atlas Society Senior Scholar Stephen Hicks and Atlas Society Founder David Kelly. They'll be answering our questions for the next 90 minutes. We want to encourage participation, but I've got questions from different channels as well. Welcome again to both of you. This has been a great forum for getting to hear your thoughts on some philosophical ideas, so I look forward to that continuing. I want to start off, this is a little bit, I'm curious if you've seen anything with ChatGPT. This latest AI, you know, has some people in shock. I saw it summarize Atlas Shrugged as a Shakespearean sonnet. I won't read it, but, you know, it was quite stirring. And, you know, it came out in seconds. And I'm wondering, does this offer pause about the nature of creativity, even the way Rand described it, at least in some of the arts?
Well, I have seen some of the chat on that and some of the machine language analyses and some about whether there's political bias built into it and so on. So it's early days for me, and I've not done a lot of investigating in it, but it certainly is intriguing, as your question suggests.
Sure.
I'm totally unfamiliar with this. So Scott, would you mind just repeating? There's some algorithm or some...
It's an AI, right. It's an AI program, and you can go into it. And, you know, it seems so far to be most effective with combining different art types, like, you know, Atlas Shrugged in the form of a Shakespearean sonnet, or, you know, just having conversations with it. I mean, there have been some, there have been some scare stories like that it had a negative view of humanity because, you know, maybe it had been programmed with woke algorithms or something. But it's just having these conversations. And I mean, it's just spitting out these, like, you know, impressive works of poetry and lyrics in its own way that show what seems like an understanding of Rand that many of her critics that have never read her, you know, you'll see as more comes out about it.
Yeah, okay. I've got to check this out because it's fascinating. It sounds just as a side point, but you know, some comedy clubs will have a musical impersonator or musical someone who asks the audience, okay, give me a topic. No. You know, the war in Ukraine or something, whatever it might be, whatever's current. And then give me a musical genre. And I was one of them once when whatever the topic was, someone said, Gregorian chant for the genre. And goddamn, that comic did not do it perfectly. Anyway, so I'm going to look this up. But getting Atlas Shrugged into a sonnet, I thought getting it, reducing Galt's speech to, you know, 4 minutes in the movie was, you know, kind of a chore. But this is into a sonnet. My gosh, I got to see this.
It might have, you know, having this tool might have helped, or we'll see.
Yeah. One quick recommendation, if I could, on this.
Sure.
David Rosado, Rozado. I would recommend that people follow him on Twitter and other places where he publishes. But he is a data scientist and a scientist of machine learning. And he's been very good at parsing out word count algorithms and using them on major media outlets to determine the kind of content and whether there are ideological shifts one way or the other. And he did a quick analysis of this program that you're referring to, Scott, just asking it basic political questions about some of the recent political controversies we've been having over race issues and so on. And on several of them, the machine or the algorithm was basically spitting out perfectly formed woke or wokest answers to the kinds of questions that would be put in there. So there's some serious initial concern about the alleged neutrality of the algorithms.
That's true. I think I remember stories from maybe 10 or 15 years ago when they were saying that certain AI programs, came off as racist or something, and I'm sure they've tried to use
Right.
that as justification for programming it.
Right.
But
So early
yeah,
days
I
left.
go ahead. I'm sorry. Again, we want to encourage people to come up. I've still got other questions as well. This person, John May, asks, knowledge and truth are under attack literally like never before. And the driver behind that attack is the application of power by wealthy people to increase their own wealth. And then in parentheses, prove me wrong. Democracy is threatened. Peace is threatened. Some of the messaging involves wokeness. Why on earth don't you comment on the problem of the application of money to bend truth for the purpose of gaining power for the few? How is that not the reigning epistemological problem of the current age?
Oh my gosh. I'll take a stab at that, and Stephen, and then you can pick up on the political assumptions. But the key epistemological problem of our age is the irrationality. It's a failure to understand the requirements of reaching conclusions by means of reason and observing, and as opposed to shooting from the hip, going by intuitions or emotions, and or engaging in what I call faux argumentation that involves confirmation bias and other fallacies. But look, I'll just say one thing, and I'd love to get Stephen your take on this, on the money aspect. Money will buy you the means of communication, but of course it does. And it's no critique of the First Amendment or a free society that recognizes the right to freedom of speech, that whether you can speak and get an audience depends a lot on how much you can put into it, on things not directly relevant to your speech, but to the money, your marketing ability, your connections, whether you can get to the media, whether et cetera, et cetera. But money has gone into big money has historically has gone into so many ideas that are now exploded. I mean, just if you take even a couple hundred years back, the Soviets put a ton of money into Lysenko's crazy biological theories. It didn't survive scientifically because it was not grounded. And so yeah, you can buy an audience and get your words out, but the idea that money rules assumes that the consumers of information and opinion are just passive victims that'll believe whatever you put out. That's not true.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have a few additional thoughts. One is that I think the application of money to the spread of ideas over the last century has had a much more democratizing effect than what this question seems to suggest, an entrenchment of elites with money and being able to bend the truth to their own power. All of the media of communication that the average person has is a powerful epistemological leveler in a way that people have access to information and arguments and debates about the significance of the information now in a way that people of past generations didn't. So I'm inclined to think that the trend is going the other way. The second thing is, I think this would be an interesting empirical matter. I've tracked some of this kind of anecdotally, but if you think about people in power, say, using money to buy influence in elections, we have this argument every time a major election comes up about who's spending money and buying access and so on. But I know that many times the winner in an election is a person who has been outspent significantly by their opponent. The opponent would put amounts of money on the order of magnitude of 20 to 30 times as much and still lose, which seems to indicate that just merely spending money to get your ideas out there and getting access is not a significantly decisive factor. Of course, you have to advertise, but it's not just a crude money buys power dynamic at work. The way David was suggesting, consumers are not passive victims. In this case, the consumers of political information who become voters are not passive victims. They can think for themselves and make their own judgment on political issues. The other thing is that this is a little bit sideways, but I always think about advertising in this context, where if it's simply a matter of money applied to communication channels gets you the influence that you want, then why is advertising not more successful? In fact, when you talk with advertisers and they have their millions and multi-million dollar budgets, they know that, of course, they have to do advertising in order to get the attention of the customers. But customers are very savvy at tuning out and evaluating. And the question is not, why is so advertising so powerful and able to shape our minds and preferences and make us buy stuff that we don't really need, when the reality seems to be the opposite, that advertising is an influencer, but it's a weak influencer. And if the spending money to get the influence that you wanted would work, then advertisers would be able to spend their dollars much better in order to get the results. Instead, they know, as they often complain, they're just wasting 50 or 60% of their advertising budget to no effect.
Well, another aspect of that, Jag just did a great interview with Dr. Aaron Carity, who was basically fired from UC Irvine for opposing the vax mandate and suing them over it. Mm. And so that's another type of where you kind of do have, there's a pressure, a feeling you have to go along to continue to get paid in certain fields.
Hmm.
Just another aspect of it. But Dessel, Drace, we engaged a little yesterday in the happy hour. He had a question in the chat. Should we be Bayesian about reasoning?
That is in my logic textbook, The Art of Reasoning, in the most recent edition, I added a section on Bayes, and I need a lot of help because I cannot wrap my mind around that method. But as I understand the method, and I assume the questioner is familiar with it, a Bayesian analysis, you have to start with some initial prior, it's called a prior guesstimate of what the initial probability of a hypothesis is. And there's something, it's always struck me as arbitrary about that, because a hypothesis, and hopefully it's based, there's some evidence that points you toward it, but and Bayesians will say that whatever your prior is, it doesn't matter, it'll get corrected over time as you get more evidence. And there's something to that. It's been used widely in science, medicine, other fields to refine formulas and understanding diseases or other complex systems that are not like billiard ball physics, where you can just, very simple, but college level computations, thanks to Newton, which is now, wasn't always obvious, but Now, those are simple because there's just mass and velocity. But in complex systems, you have to do a lot more significant testing. And Bayesian theory may be a useful tool. I don't think it's the only tool. And I would counsel anyone. So I would not say that it's incompatible with, for example, the objectivist epistemology. It just is one among many inductive tools that anyone engaged in real science, real investigation can use, but only in taking account of all of other methods and the context of previous knowledge.
Good. Stephen, anything you wanted to add?
No, nothing to add.
Okay. Well, again, we want to encourage people with questions to ask. I still have many more questions myself. You know, how do you differentiate when someone is being practical versus pragmatic? Or a pragmatist, I should say.
Well, I'll take a quick jump on that one. The word pragma, going back to the Greek, means deed or work or practicality. So in that sense, being practical and being pragmatic are synonyms etymologically. The difference between pragmatic with a small p and pragmatism is that pragmatism is an explicit philosophy about what it is to be practical. And the pragmatists historically came out of a somewhat skeptical tradition that we've been arguing about the nature of truth and what is certainty, and arguing that all of these abstract prior concerns about first getting strong knowledge or truth claims that we can believe within a certain amount of with a strong amount of certainty before we act on them is not reflective of actual human action, and maybe a kind of a Don Quixote type of quest for something that's unrealizable. So pragmatism as a philosophy then says we shouldn't be first concerned about truth and knowledge. Instead, what we should do is just act, just try things and see what works or not. And if it works, then the next time we seem to be in the same situation, do the same sort of thing, but be open to the idea that circumstances change a lot. And so we might need to be flexible in our action. So it emphasizes action more than knowledge, emphasizes flexibility more than firm principles. And on the basis of that, it then, as a matter of conclusion, says that's what it is to be a practical person. By contrast, a non-pragmatist would say we should be concerned with knowledge and consistently applying our knowledge. Knowledge is not a chimerical quest that we can't acquire it, and that once we acquire knowledge, we should translate that into principles of action and stick with those principles of action consistently, and that those principles of action will be quite universal and general guides throughout one's life. Now, that's me trying to make a neutral just statement about the difference between a pragmatist and a non-pragmatist understanding of knowledge and action.
Yeah, I just end up getting accused of being a pragmatist for suggesting that, you know, we take actions in the world to influence policy and things like that. So that's where the question came from. But I want to welcome John to the stage. John, thanks for your patience.
Thank you. This is an elementary question, not even sophomoric, and it goes to epistemology and mysticism and the boundary between the two. For instance, if I develop a theory about what some fact is, and I want to test it against a positivistic or empirical principle. We call that a theory, but it seems to me that the history of human knowledge is one of people developing theories or ideas about what exists, and then some technology of investigation validates or invalidates it. For instance, I might have had a theory about germs before the investigation or the invention of the microscope, or about the stars before the invention of the telescope, or about subatomic particles before the atomic microscope, etc. And so what do you call that part of epistemology that is that defines that? And I might say that all of the mysteries of the universe amount to, there must be, allowing me to have some kind of a mystical belief about there ought to be something out there. And the only thing I lack is evidence that that something exists. So I guess that's my question. How does epistemology become not arbitrary? Why is it not arbitrary, given the history of the acquisition of human knowledge?
Go ahead, David. Sure.
I'll take a stab at that. And Stephen, this is your field as well. But look, the part of the answer, I think, is that the absence of knowledge does not entail, or does not provide anyone with a belief, with a reason for believing in anything. The lack of evidence is not evidence for anything. That's the well-known fallacy of appeal to ignorance. We know what we know, and our knowledge is expanding continuously. And I mean, I was just talking to a friend of mine today about some scientific speculation, and it's just astounding. I'm in awe of everything that the people in our age right now, what scientists and, for that matter, philosophers and historians have established. It's all inspiring, but it's only, every advance raises new questions. That's kind of a cliche. And those questions need to be answered in the same way that the knowledge we have already acquired is, by reason, by observation, by using what evidence we have to raise questions. And there are questions, some questions are grounded in facts. That is, there's something like, take the germs. We know that something is causing illness. And we, at a certain point in time, we had evidence, we had knowledge that.
Wait, right there. I mean, we're maybe returning to the fallacy of ignorance. People get sick. People wonder why. It's the nature of humanity, of the human brain, to wonder why and to seek explanations. And therefrom comes religion. But it also, therefrom comes science and knowledge. So we wonder why, and the application of the why gives us the tools of discovery. So how do you draw that line?
I can jump in a little here. I'm struck by John's examples of the germs and the atoms prior to microscopes and atomic microscopes and so on. It does strike me that even if we don't have direct perceptual evidence of this, we do have a capacity for imagination, and we come up with, in some cases, speculative hypotheses, and we engage in analogical thinking where we transfer what we know from one domain into this current unknown domain and try out ideas in that area. And all of that is in the asking why and seeking possible explanations stage before we have anything that we would call knowledge. So I would say that is part of human cognitive capacity, and it is indeed a source of scientific knowledge, and it's one very often in the history of science, one of the stages our thinking goes through before we get into kind of serious hardcore science. But I would resist the idea that in some sense that is mystical, or that any sort of non-rational language is the right language to use to describe what we are doing when we are at that stage of semi-knowledge or pre-knowledge. Mysticism, at least as it's used in religion and in cognitive studies more generally, usually means a non-rational source of knowledge that's non-sensory, it's non-conceptual, it's non-propositional, and it can't be explained by those who don't have that mystical experience. So how does that sound, John?
Very good, Stephen. Thank you. So let's examine further the term.
I do want to let Daniel get in a little bit.
Well, okay, but pre-knowledge, what is that? How do we distinguish pre-knowledge from knowledge or from religiosity? I mean, when you know there's something
else. Well, that's where I think that the formal canons of epistemology are going to come in. When you are speculating or trying out imaginative hypotheses, you need to self-reflectively be aware that you are doing so. And so, we will say things, this is just a speculation, or I'm only trying out a hypothesis here. And so you're not assigning any knowledge claim to what you are doing at that stage. You're trying to come up with a model of some sort that you are then going to put to the empirical test, if you're able to do so, or to see if it fits with your what you know in other domains, some sort of coherence test. So you're putting yourself in a mode where you are assigning some degree of probability or possibility only to the ideas that you are entertaining. Now, if you're not doing that, if you're making a stronger claim than the evidence warrants, or if you're speculating but you're not acknowledging that you're speculating, then some forms of religiosity, wishful thinking, faithfulness, and so on, that kind of language becomes more appropriate to describe what's going on.
Okay, so we're dealing with what the rules for what a knowledge claim is. At some point, is that not arbitrary? The rules.
John, can I answer that? There is an epistemological question or issue, goes back a long way, called the problem of the criterion, to distinguish knowledge from, not knowledge, beliefs that don't count as knowledge. We need some criterion for distinguishing them. And then how do we justify the criterion? So I think that's related to your question. Why is it not arbitrary, the distinction? Because if the criteria for establishing something as true and not, something we know are arbitrary, then we're just going around in circles, and we haven't gotten anywhere. But there is an answer to that, which is the axioms. All of knowledge is governed by axioms, that there's a world there, it exists, that things have identities, that we are conscious, and that consciousness, our minds are functioned by grasping a reality, although we can go wrong in many ways at the conceptual level. All of this is foundational, and these things are axioms in the sense that they are self-evident. You can observe their truth, and they are not, you can't analyze them any further or ask why is existence an axiom? Well, what would you take as an answer? something outside existence? No, it's these are part and parcel of, or not part and parcel, they are the foundation of epistemology and of metaphysics. So if you compromise them, if you negate them, then you are out of the cognitive business. You are doing something else, but it's not knowledge. And so it's not our, I think one of the great things about the objectivist epistemology is that it does have an answer to that problem of the criterion. And I could send you an essay I wrote some years ago on this, but not to get, you know, into that. It's
thank you, David. But I'll leave it.
Let me just add one anecdote. I was at a debate some time back about intelligent design, the theory that the best scientific theory of nature is that it was designed by some intelligent being. And they don't specify that it's a Christian God or the Islamic God, it's just an intelligent being. And I asked the person who was defending that thesis, okay, if that's a scientific hypothesis, is there any evidence that would trouble you about that? Any evidence that would count against that? And I'm not invoking Popper's falsifiability thesis here. It's just that if this is a theory about the world that's based, that is scientific in nature, must be based on something, and that means you'd be able to imagine evidence against it if you were to find that evidence, you know, run an experiment, do a test, whatever, and find evidence that was inconsistent with it. And he had no answer. It was obviously just a matter.
Briefly, David, my point is only that before the microscope, a theory of germs was nothing more than a religion. The moment after the microscope, it became knowledge. That's all I'm trying to say. That's my question.
Thank you, John.
Okay, I think that's there's more to say about this, John, but I do want
to give some others a chance. We may come back to it if we have time. Daniel, thank you for your patience.
Scott?
Or go ahead.
I'm not quite ready to let this one go. Just
go ahead.
Use of the word religion there. I want to push back a little on that because that germs existed. If one was entertaining that idea before being able to verify it with microscopes and so on, I agree. There are lots of people who had that idea, were speculating about it. I don't think the religion is the right word, because if we want to call something religious, standard, we have to be saying that in some sense, what we are believing in is a non-natural or a supernatural being or entity or reality. And belief in a germ at that stage is not appealing to any sort of supernatural causation. And the other way we use religion is to say that the person is believing it in a non-rational fashion. They're claiming some sort of mystical insight, or it's a matter of faith. And I don't see that that's the case either. In the history of germ theory, the people who were proposing it as a hypothesis weren't doing any of those things. They were saying, this is a hypothesis. This is something that we can imagine that fits with various other models. We just don't yet have any empirical evidence of it. So it's not fully scientific, but it certainly is not a candidate for religious belief either.
It could be a whole episode. Daniel, thank you for joining us. Go ahead. Are you able to unmute? It's the bottom right button.
Can you hear me?
There you are.
All right, great. Yeah, so I have a meta-ethics question. It involves life, value, and facing a fundamental alternative. So this comes from the objectivist notion that life is the standard of value, and only entities that face a fundamental alternative can have values. And Rand gives the thought experiment about an immortal, indestructible robot that can have no goals or values. And related to that, my question is, suppose technology got advanced enough, like say nanotechnology, biotechnology, life extension technology, to where man's physical survival is, for all intents and purposes, guaranteed. And using the notion life is a standard of value, and for man that would mean, say, survival qua man, qua rational being. In that context, what would survival qua man mean?
I'll jump in with one point. I've never liked that example of Rand's. It just raises too many sci-fi questions and counter-speculation. But leaving that aside, the notion that life is contingent, that it's an alternative, has two elements. One is we are subject to death if we do not at any time, if we run into an accident, if we do not provide for ourselves. And that's one thing. We are vulnerable. Second, but it's also the case, the meaning of mortality is also that we're going to die. At some point, we are going to pass away. So what you're doing is imagining, Daniel, that, we've solved the necessity of death issue, and we can now live indefinitely. But unless you can extend that in some way to say that we are actually indestructible, that we will continue at, not just as alive, but as the people that we are, the individuals, the rational thinking, conscious subjects in physical bodies that we are right now. Unless you're saying that we could become invulnerable. In that sense, to my mind, that would change the ethics, or at least certainly raise the question, because it would mean we're more like stones or mountains that have no values. But I'm not aware of anyone saying that. Of course, there's a whole nother question. If death was not something that we would all encounter and we would live forever. Stephen wrote years and years ago, Stephen, you remember that paper you wrote on what would it like to be immortal?
Yeah, I do remember.
It does raise some issues about how that would change our values, goals, expectations, and so forth. I'm not dismissing the question. I'm just saying that it doesn't invalidate the whole point about life as an alternative.
So I guess also I was trying to convey that it was indestructibility would be part of that. Essentially, like you're saying, death is it's not a thing anymore as far as the physical body goes. And so the existence of the physical body is unconditional. Would survival qua man have any meaning at that point?
Can I ask for one further clarification on that thought experiment? So is it that in principle, one would be immortal, so you could continue to do various things to maintain your immortality? I don't know, like getting a liver transplant every 100 years or whatever it is? Or is that... the immortality, yes, would be fixed, and so could you still opt out of life if you chose, or has one literally become indestructible?
That's a good question. I would say someone could opt out, so they could in their life, yeah, voluntarily if they so chose.
Yeah, and that makes it a more interesting question, because then you still have the option there. And then you're going to have to make a value judgment about whether you want to stay alive or not. And how do you make that value judgment in that thought experiment set of conditions?
And I think, you know, a lot of life extension is just about stopping the diseases of aging. And there's almost an element of being truly indestructible that seems like, you know, I mean, you can sort of theoretically imagine it, but it's almost a violation of the law of identity that something can't just be turned into, like, you know, liquefied or turned into a gas or pulverized. But even in the Highlander, you could get your head cut off. But I want to welcome Liberty Shamrocker. I don't know why I'm using that name, Connie. Welcome to the stage.
Oh, either one's fine. Call me anything but late for dinner.
Nice.
Any question?
I do. Recently, I think, you know, I'm on the council board of You Are the Power, and we're currently doing a rebranding and setting up allies and different things like that. So I've been forced to look at different things that I hadn't perspective-wise before and doing, you know, my charts and so forth. And it's looking like an ESG score is becoming more and more important with things. And I'm just wondering the impact, because I know that it's gone everything, whether it be global or countrywide, down to the individual. So I was just wondering what the panel feels about the importance of ESGs.
Oh, man. Stephen?
and remind me, ESG is environment, sustainability, and...
What's governance, the maybe?
I'll governance. Look it up. Governance. Yes. Okay. Right. Yeah. So this is something that has evolved out of the business ethics literature, and then more narrowly within that, the corporate governance literature. And to my mind, is just two debates rolled into one. One is just general concerns about environmental issues and the sustainability. Issues is just another repackaging of environmental issues, and then issues of governance, about what you know, what proper corporate governance should be, to the extent things should be based on property rights or democratic criteria, respect for rights and various kinds of constituencies. So, you know, at a high level of abstraction, I think the issues are perfectly fine. What should one's environmental policy be, and what should one's governance policy be? The difficult thing is that people who have been, for the most part, pushing the ESG have a very narrow understanding of what the correct answers to environmental policy are, and what the right answers to proper corporate governance are. And for the most part, they've not been coming out of a business-friendly or a market-friendly understanding of the way business should be done. And almost all of the paradigms or the theories that I have seen do start with an assumption either that businesses and corporations are amoral, in which case they need to have various ethical principles kind of imposed upon them or grafted upon them from the outside, right, or that corporations and business more generally are immoral. And so ESG then is a tool to counter what's seen as nefarious corporate influence. So depending on whether you mean ESG in the more generic or the more specific sense, I think the answer would be different. So I think the only way to respond to your question particularly is to get down into the weeds and start looking at particular, you know, ESG criteria and packages of criteria, and analyzing them on their own merits.
Well, can I just jump in with a question for Liberty?
Connie.
Connie. Thank you, Connie. It's a question about the social component of ESG. Does that mean, or the social or governance, I'm not sure. Does that enfold in a stakeholder versus a shareholder model of the way corporations should work?
Actually, both. You know, when you're looking at a nonprofit, you've got to look at, you know, at the OKRs of it. And, you know, of course, you want to portray empathy, and you want to put a weight to every cause that you're working on and so forth. But at the same time, there's lots of causes out there, but you've got to have somebody come with money. So I'd say both.
Isn't the philosophies of liberty, are they not about self-dominion and self-ownership? And I regard ESG as contrary to the very idea of property rights.
If I could just say quickly, I mean, it can be, but also it can be compatible with property rights. So property rights, for example, are one way of solving environmental problems. You know, that your property is something that I can't throw my trash on. So I, as a responsible neighbor to you, will respect your property rights, and that's how we're going to solve that particular problem. The non-property rights assumption, though, is typically to say that property rights bring various other problems, and we can't expect people who are taking their property rights seriously to care about other people's property, so we need to have some external body impose a don't throw trash restriction on both of us, and have some governance method that's going to enforce it.
Great. Let's bring in Poodle Schnoodle. Thanks for joining. Are you able to?
Hey, go guys, ahead. Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay, great. Stephen, hey, I love your book on postmodernism.
Thank you.
Yeah. So if you look on the back of my profile there, I have the poem, you know, turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer, things fall apart, and the center cannot hold. Yes. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. And I put that poem on the back of my profile because that's really how I feel. In recent years, there's been a lot of really bad thinking. I don't even know if you could classify it as thinking. Certainly not reason and not logic. You know, we've got Kanye West on television blaming, you know, the typical scapegoats, the Jews, and then people like Alex Jones and Trump denying that he lost the election, which I feel has an acidic effect on the democratic process. And not just from the left or right, but from both sides, a lot of ideological thinking. Not much of this language is glued to reality. It's not really careful. And you know, bringing this back to your book on postmodernism, I saw it as an attempt, your book, to really, it was your attempt to combat nonsense in a way. You know, you gave the example of the very early postmodernists and their attempt to salvage communist economic ideals by basically denying reality, if I read that correctly. And I see this blame game. Yeah. And I see this blame game going on, this very kind of communistic mindset, or this very bad, inarticulated language on TV. Is there any way that we can sort of combat these, you know, these identity politics? I think they're really getting out of hand. I feel that they are breaking society apart. I feel that anytime a group of folks is doing better or worse, if they're doing better, it must be that they've cheated somehow to get there. And if they're doing worse, it's because the rest of the world is against them. And I just don't find that to be, I find that type of thinking to be very, very simplistic. And so far as I understand from having read at least just one book of yours, I think you believe same. What can we do to sort of, you know, and then if, I don't know if how often you're on Clubhouse, but if you go in some of these rooms, the lower the IQ of the room, the more of this blame game goes on, the more hatred, the more anger. What can we do? What can we do what advice Good do you question. Have for us that really want to, you know, turn people on to critical thinking? What's your suggestion?
Well, that's a very thoughtful, heartfelt question. I was struck, and I especially liked your phrase, thinking that is not glued to reality. That's great. So gluing your thinking to reality. I'm going to perhaps borrow that at some point. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. There are a lot of disturbing trends, cognitive and anti-cognitive trends that are out there, and all kinds of movements and people coming out of the woodwork and coming up with all kinds of crazy things. And rather than simply being marginalized, they do seem to have loud voices and to be able to leverage their views in important cultural sectors, and all of that is very, very distressing. At the same time, I'm tempted to go back to C.P. Snow, who in the middle part of the 20th century wrote an interesting essay called The Two Cultures, and he was talking about intellectual culture in mostly the English-speaking world at that time, where there was this bifurcation between rational, scientific, logical, progressive thinking in the intellectual world, and that was mostly in the sciences and the social sciences and related disciplines as well. But then a distressing amount of irrationalism that had captured the art world and much of the humanities, where to the extent that you are explicitly irrational in your beliefs and your lifestyle, you are celebrated within that subculture. And Snow was wondering how we had gotten to the point where among intellectuals who are supposed to be educated people, we could have these two polar opposite cultures, both of which despised each other. And they seemed to have split the intellectual turf among them. One side was taking the humanities and taking it in an increasingly irrational direction. The other side was taking the sciences and taking it in a more rational, progressive direction. And then what can we do to overcome this dichotomy and have a more unified, integrated science and humanistic culture in a progressive direction? So sociologically, it seems that we're in a similar situation to that, as David was alluding to earlier in this clubhouse. We start talking to the scientists and the engineers and the technologists, and it's just astounding currently how much they are learning and doing and creating. And there's a very healthy intellectual and value subculture at work, and that still is a huge part of who we are. But then at the same time, we have the postmoderns and all of their offshoots, and they're a big part of who we are culturally right now. And it seems to be an inexhaustible well of resentments and abilities to shock us and find new ways to do disgusting and irrational things. So we have this incredibly bifurcated culture. And so your question, I think, is the right one. What can we do to get past this? Now, my view, it's not my view alone, I think it's the objectivist view, is that bad philosophy is the most important cause for our current predicaments. Just as good philosophy, significant portions of it coming out of the Enlightenment are the cause of all the good things that are in our culture. So while I do think there's a huge division of labor here, and people in all cultural areas and intellectual areas have work to do, the most important battle is the philosophical battle. So what I would say is not that become a philosopher, but at least be philosophical about whatever your area of expertise is, and be an up-to-speed, decent, thoughtful person with good philosophy, and bring that to bear in your cultural sphere. And that would be the thing that's most rewarding to you and the most likely to help us with our problem.
And but no short answer to convince people that are idiots that they're actually not thinking well. Yeah. I mean, no short answer to I view thinking as a very difficult process. You know, it takes some time to do it. And I think a lot of folks believe that stating an opinion or, you know what, like, let's say you have this Alex Jones character who's really interesting to listen to because he's like the Norm from Cheers. Remember Norm? He's really good at bringing up these little tidbits of information. You know, in 1947 on July 13th, such and such happened, right? And then he'll bring up another little tidbit of information. You know, did you know that Genghis Khan had 99 wives or something? Okay. So, and then, he's great and imaginative. So he can sow this relationship between, you know, the 99 wives of Genghis Khan and whatever happened on June 13th, 1947. And then his listeners are like, they slap themselves in the head and they're like, geez, why didn't I notice that, you know? It's just that the folks listening to him or any conspiracy theory, I think they don't realize the difference between reasoning and the brain's tendency to just create patterns, you know? And I think that's... I think, you know, especially with this guy, Kanye West, he's throwing out all these very, very old tropes. And I think his audience for the first time is like hearing this. They may not be, you know, as well versed in the history of anti-Semitic tropes and then reptilians and Anunnaki and then the Nazis and blah, 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 blah. And if they're introduced to this, to them, it appears to be almost sense-making in a way. So when I go into these rooms on Clubhouse and I try to explain, look, your thinking is wrong. If you want to learn about economics, just please read a basic book on economics. Or if you want to know about history, read a generic history book. And their retort is, well, you know, those mainstream history books, we can't trust them. So I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
I would just add, I'd like to add one thing. I'd love the fact that you've, Yeats's poem, Second Coming, is one of my favorites. And when I think about these issues and the contrast Stephen drew, going back to C.P. Snow about the two cultures, the line that just really hits me is in the first stanza when Yeats says, "The ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction. The worst are full of passionate intensity."
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because irrational, passionate language is interesting, you know?
All right.
And that is... you know, when Yeats wrote that a century ago or more, I mean, it was prescient. But my God, what a description of our age and of the division, of the stark contrast between the crap that gets out in public media and on political, moral, social topics and its infected literature and other academic fields versus the extraordinary technology that over my lifetime, I'm in my 70s now, I wrote my thesis on an electric typewriter. Remember what those were? I mean, someone invented the internet and computers, all that stuff. And the brain power that goes into that and the sheer intelligence and the conviction, once, you know, a rational conviction, there are people out there with that. So here's my, I guess, my point. Ayn Rand has been criticized a lot for being emphatic in expressing her views. Well, I think we need more emphaticness. We need more intensity among the best. And, you know, in other Clubhouse rooms, you know, I appreciate you're up against this. a difficult task. But I think if we said, look, there are certain things that are true and we're not taking any prisoners on this, it is this is the way it is. And if you don't, if you're going to spew this stuff that has no basis, I'm not going to listen to you. Shut up.
Yeah.
That's my rant.
One more thought here is in response to this very good question. I think there is no short answer. There is the long road of philosophy and the long road for each of us in education. That's a multi-year process, and philosophy and thinking about whatever one's thinking about is always going to be hard work. But at the same time, if we step away from that perspective and think about the history and the sociology of it, we go back to Yeats and his generation. Yes, there were the Dadaists and the Surrealists and other forms of irrationalism. On this other side of the culture, there was all of the good progressive scientific rational stuff that was going on. We jump 50 years to Rand's generation, 60s. You had the performance artists and all kinds of druggies and weirdos going on. And at the same time, the other side of the culture is making progress economically, scientifically, and so on. And now in our generation, we still have the same divide. So perhaps one of the cautiously optimistic lessons is that overall, our culture is progressive, rational, and scientific, and it can absorb and tolerate a significant minority of people who are just outright irrational. So the irrationalists are, you know, likely going to be with us for all time, but maybe we are ascribing them outsized cultural power, and that in fact we're a lot healthier than we think. Now that's a kind of a journalistic or a sociological claim. We need empirical evidence for it.
Staying ahead of the wave.
Yeah.
Brian, thank you for your patience.
No worries. Thanks, Scott. Professor Hicks, I mean, I think it would be great to see you, do a more lengthy discussion on metaethics. I would love to see a commentary going through, say, like the summary of Rand's philosophy as listed out on, say, like Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy or something like that, as a backdrop.
Okay.
I have several questions, so I'm trying to pick one. And I think ultimately, one of them is really, I want to hear what you think what you think is maybe even the biggest concern in metaethics today. Is it error theory? Is it, what do you think sort of the biggest issue is in metaethics today? And then if I had to say, there might be a related second question, I guess, why should people adopt Rand's philosophy? And why in particular, what I want to ask is, why should people who are spiritual and or religious and have that as a basis for their ethics adopt her philosophy? Anyway, that's my question.
Yeah. On the first question, I don't think I have a good answer about, because I'm not, for the last at least 5 years, reading much of what's going on in metaethics right now. I've been working on other things, so I can't answer that question.
Getting right a tan now. On a beach, is that? No, I'm just kidding.
That's part of the plan for next summer, I guess.
Well deserved.
So the third question was an interesting one. If you start with people who are religious and they have a certain understanding of what ethics is, how would one talk to them about making objectivist ethics attractive to them? I think my first thing there would be a pushback for more clarification on what we mean by the religious ethics, because that's an awfully big tent. And in religious ethics, there are lots of people who are worldly in their ethics. They want to live a happy life in the here and now. And that means, making a good living, having rewarding friendships and a good sex life and raising their families and traveling the world. And they think that requires also having strong moral principles, and that some sort of spiritual being is the underwriter of those moral values. And that's what their religious ethics consists in. But that's in marked contrast to more extreme forms of religious ethic that are much more ascetic and anti-humanistic and anti-worldly. So I think first, if you're talking with religious people, you need to listen to them and get a better sense for what's going on in their understanding of religion. So then you can respond more precisely.
Yeah, I think if I was to be more clear, I would just say, I actually think that there's a great opportunity sort of to resolve what appears to be like inherent selfishness in the way that Rand's philosophy is presented, to say sort of like maybe Christian ethics of selflessness. I think those things can be resolved, but I also think people would be hesitant to resolve them if they thought that they would have to also give up their belief in God. And I think that's the conflict I'm really getting at, because I think actually in practice, many Christians believe exactly the thing that, you know, Rand believes about work ethic and so on and so forth.
Right. Well, I do know personally a lot of people who are, they think of themselves as Christian objectivists. In effect, for many of them, what it seems to amount to is everything in objectivism, just a belief in a God as an overseer, manager of the universe in a very general sense. And so they are they're close to being pantheistic in that sense. So, but I did like the way you put it. Then you started to say, even if you resolved, say, the apparent dichotomy between their understanding of selflessness and the objectivist understanding of self-interest, there would still be other issues that would need to be attended to. They're still going to hang on to a belief in God because their God is doing other intellectual or psychological work for them. And you need to know what that is in order to know how to respond.
Sure. For instance, the afterlife, I guess, which goes back to the earlier question of, you know, if we become indestructible, are some people motivated perhaps to meet their maker if they believe in a maker?
Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
If I could add something here, over the years, I've asked people who have religious beliefs, and mostly focusing on people that I had a lot of respect for, including people who worked for the Atlas Society, but they were not in positions that required that they be objectivists, just that they be skilled and responsible in what they do. But I've asked, what does religion do for you? And I've given a lot of thought to it. I've made out a chart of all the things, all the needs that religion potentially once satisfied, and still some of them satisfies. For example, religion no longer provides a whole lot of information. It's not a player in the explanation of nature. We have science now. Or the control of nature. We have science and technology. But one of the things I kept hearing was someone to look after me. Someone who's got, that I can appeal to when my life is not, when I'm feeling my life is not going well as I'd want, or I'm in danger, or I'm threatened. And I think that's a powerful motive. And then, of course, the end of life issues. You know, religion still has a major role to play in giving people a sense of the meaning of their lives and what happens at the end. And those are hard because, from a secular standpoint, the end is the end. So, But the ethics is also crucial, I agree. And if you think about Americans anyway, and a lot of people elsewhere in the world, are they functioning like altruists, really? No. They all want to make good incomes. They want their kids to flourish and do well and make even better incomes. They go on vacations. And they do not spend their money down like the philosopher Peter Singer advocates, that we spend to the point where we are no better off than third world people by giving away everything above that level to third world people. No, very few people operate in that basis, thankfully and rightly. But I do think it is important, as Stephen was saying, and you are alluding to it, to clarify that selfishness is does not mean, it includes benevolence, let me put it that way, to cite my own views here, that it includes benevolence. It is not savage. It's a win-win way of dealing with people, and but sacrifice is not good. And people think of, you know, they feel like I've got to sacrifice something or I can't justify my life. It's like, you know, moral laundering. So anyway, enough said. There's a lot more we could say, but the first thing I would do in terms of talking with people is just ask, okay, what is religion doing for you? Because you can't address people or change minds without knowing where their minds are.
It's almost like not being able to assume a Marxist is automatically evil.
You could say that.
Okay. You mentioned the chart, David. I would like to see that if you've got that published somewhere. That could be a useful tool. Another category, just in response to this very good question, another circle of people I know, we're all getting older now, but people when they became parents in their late 20s and early 30s, and these were usually, you know, professional people, well-educated, doing well in their careers, and they started their families when they were in a position of doing so. And they were not at all especially religious until they had their children. And then when their children were old enough, they started going to church. And I would talk about with them about why they were doing so. And it wasn't really that they had changed their metaphysics and they were believing in supernatural beings, or changed their epistemology and now we're becoming more faithful and religious. But it was a matter of ethics, that they wanted to have a social reinforcing institution that was going to instill in their children and reinforce what they were doing at home, that there are these very firm moral principles and you need to be a good person in order, according to these principles. And from their perspective, when they were, these were people who would read a lot about how to raise your children and so on. So they were clearly prospecting for where am I going to get a moral code and some sort of institution that can help me instill a strong moral code in my children. And the only or the best answer they were coming up with was kind of organized religion. And that's really the only reason they were going to church. They might also get some additional social benefits out of it, but that was really, really the driver.
Great point, Stephen. Yeah. I agree completely.
And just as a way of thanks, if I may. So, David, I mean, I thought your tenor was wonderful. Thanks for that, yeah. Stephen. I think, you know, when I read at least the summary of Rand, I'm not deeply read, but, you know, it's this sort of development process of the youth that she sees as, you know, when it's flawed, there's a bad outcome. So maybe in a sense, I think really what I'm trying, you know, to almost ask is, you know, might certain groups of people that don't strictly hold to the atheist subjectivist view actually have, you know, common goals in mind and even some methods that might, you know, if we take sort of an older view in philosophy through the light of reason, even if they see that as a divine gift, be aiming at the same ends. Anyway, that I'll stop there and just want to thank you for your answers.
No, thanks for that. That's a good question.
Thank you.
Great. I do want to recognize senior scholar Richard Salzman in the audience. He did have a question in the chat. He may not be available, but he says, for decades now, we've seen documentaries and movies about Nazis. Why is there such a dearth of similar coverage of the Soviet Union and Maoist China? Is there any philosophical explanation of this? The latter countries inflicted 10 times more death and misery.
Oh, man.
The question is, Steve,
you follow this a lot more carefully than I do. But part of the answer is just obvious. The left appealed to equality and the brotherhood of man. The Nazi, the left totalitarians. The right appealed to a hierarchical, exclusionary, you know, in the case of the Nazis, Aryan dominance, ethnic superiority. And for a lot of people, those are the issues, equality versus hierarchy. They don't think about freedom versus collectivism. And that's why they don't see these two as both the Nazis and the communists as similar. But the reason you don't see many movies on the horrors of communism is that it's still in many minds of many artists, thinkers, philosophers, whatever, it is still regarded as a flawed approach to an ideal, whereas the Nazis are a flawed approach to a negative ideal, hateful. Cool. And it comes from, you know, it's the same, it goes back, I can trace it back to the attitudes in the New Testament that, you know, blessed are the poor, for they shall inherit the earth. But be that as it may, I do want, in that respect, I do want to recommend an article that's on our website by Alan Kors, K-O-R-S. It's called After Socialism. It was something he wrote. He gave it as a talk many years ago for us. It is devastating about the body count of communism and why it has never been acknowledged. And if you ever heard Alan Kors speak, he sounds like a New Testament or Old Testament prophet. I mean, it's the most powerful thing I've ever seen. So, or heard. Anyway, but I think it traces back to the political affiliation of people on the liberal side toward an altruist basis for their political beliefs. And that's why, I mean, years ago, the political thinker called James Burnham coined the phrase "Il n'y a pas d'ennemi à gauche." There is no enemy to the left. We may think they're mistaken. We don't think they're evil. But Stephen, you followed this a lot more closely than I have.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you say. Let me second, especially the recommendation of Alan Kors's piece on this. It's absolutely first rate and morally compelling. There's a lot more work to do in holding communism's feet to the fire for its disasters. Just a couple of additional quick thoughts. Richard's question was asking about philosophical reasons, and there is in philosophy a divide between, I think this is a false division, between those who judge according to intents and motives and those who judge according to consequences. And in this case, it's clear that many people are not judging according to consequences. So the fact that the communist body count is much higher than the National Socialist body count, that's a consequentialist consideration, and that doesn't register. Instead, what they are looking at is the intents or the motivations involved. And there, David's point about are you motivated by equality or are you motivated by hierarchy? That is the decisive issue. And if you're more comfortable with equality and opposed to hierarchy, then that's going to be the one that you focus on. And since the Nazis were hierarchy people, that's the one that you're going to most demonize. So it's a more deontological ethical principle as one standard of judgment that is operative. Now that's perhaps pitching it a little bit to, higher than is appropriate in this case, but also a lot of it's going to have to do because you know Dr. Salzman's question is about the movie industry in particular, and so we need to know something about the demographics of people in the movie industry as well. And a lot of the great creativity in the movie industry was homegrown Americans, but a lot of it also was people who got out of Germany and Central Europe in the middle part of the 20th century because of the rise of Nazism. And many of them were already left-leaning in their sympathies toward communism. And they came over to America and then went to work in creative fields and in Hollywood here. So you might just for demographic reasons expect to have a higher proportion of people attacking political developments, including Nazism in the movies than what's going on in the Soviet Union. I think also, though, one other thing just is that the Holocaust is a horrible, horrible event. And as horrible as the Gulag was in Siberia, there is something extra, you know, evil and demonic about the way the Holocaust was carried out. And so that may be a thing that's an additional factor that pushes us over the tipping edge to seeing the Nazis as uniquely evil and capturing the imagination of people in the film industry. And so another part of the explanation why there's so much more focus there.
Great. Thank you for that. In our last few minutes, even though we're rational animals, did Ayn Rand not grant enough to the part of us that we share with animals by, she basically thought the conceptual realm changed everything, but it's not like a light switch. There's kind of a more of a dimmer effect. And I mean, I see jealousy in my dogs and things like that.
Yeah, my cats have personalities, and I have to remind myself every once in a while that their personalities are completely my attribution to them. I mean, they have different personalities, but I don't know what a cat psychology is, so I'm reading my own into them. But there's something you got to keep in mind. Rand's ethics is biocentric. She saw human beings as a species, and she put human life in the context of a kind of ethology. What do species of different, what do animals of different species require to make, to meet their needs through the exercise of their capacities? And it's very easy to put her ethics into that context. She focuses on human beings, of course, because she was doing ethics, which rests on the capacity for choice, free will, and so forth. So we need an ethics. Animals don't need an ethics. They have their, as far as we know, none of them have volition in the way we do. But which I consider an open scientific question. So I don't want to get into that issue. But the But Rand did actually almost uniquely among philosophers, ethical philosophers, I think, took account of the basic biological facts of human existence. I don't know, Stephen, you're more up on ethics than I am, but my sense is that there are very few ethical philosophers, at least in the Anglo-American tradition, and maybe continental as well, that who don't just start with human life, but go back to, okay, human life is life. What's life about?
Right. Now, that point is absolutely right. Historically, almost the entirety of the history of ethics is the assumption that ethics is a free-floating area of investigation. In some cases, it's explicitly divorced from not only biology, but the entire natural world. Now, Aristotle is an exception. He has a largely biocentric basis for his ethics. And the hedonists would be another example of some nod toward biology. But until you get into the modern world, not very much at all. Nietzsche is another exception where he's explicitly basing his ethics on an understanding of human biology and kind of reducing psychology to biological imperatives. And then much of 20th century ethics in the first part of the 20th century it was explicitly non-naturalistic.
Right.
No way at all of connecting ethics to the natural world. So Rand and an interesting coterie of women philosophers in the middle part of the 20th century are really pioneers at reintroducing biology to ethics. Now, I think perhaps in the question, there are, when you get down into the weeds of it and you start looking at specific issues, what's Rand's view about the relationship between love and sex and this, that, and the other thing? Did she take as much account of biology as one should? There I think we're open to argument, but at least in the general tenor and approach of her philosophy, it is one of the most important points about Rand that ethics needs to be situated biologically.
Sure. I just mean, when you see things like Coco signing, for example, so sometimes the line gets blurred between what is conceptual understanding.
Of course it gets blurred, and but at the same time, there is a difference in kind that comes into effect. If we start saying, what other species are there out there that do math and get jokes and compose poems and think about 100 years into the future and the far reaches of the galaxy and do archaeology and so on, the range and power of our conceptual faculty, at the margins, yes, other animals have some degree of intelligence, but nonetheless, there is something extraordinarily beyond that threshold about human beings, and that is hugely significant to vast amounts of what it is to be a human.
This almost circles back to my first point about ChatGPT and creativity. So, actually a good place to wrap up. We are doing big things next year at the Atlas Society, and we had a donor for this year agree to match all new donors. So every $5 means $10 for our student initiatives. All current donors, anything they give over their 2021 giving will also be matched. So, as you evaluate your year-end philanthropic givings, I hope you take into account the full scope of our impact. Great sessions like this. and decide to include the Atlas Society in your year-end plans. So thank you both. Thank you to everyone for joining us with questions. And we'll come back and do this again next month.
Okay. All right. Thanks, David. And thanks, Scott, for hosting.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks all as well. And to all of our participants for great questions.